There is a word of the day today, gang, and it is not healthcare. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, July the 13th. Glad to have you with us, everybody, as we always are. The word of the day today comes to us courtesy of the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Mick Mulvaney is his name. Writing on the op-ed page today of the Wall Street Journal about the Trump administration's economic vision for this country.
If the Trump administration has one overarching goal, it's to make America great again. But what does this mean? It means we are promoting MAGAnomics, and that means sustained 3% economic growth.
Not actually, Mr. Mulvaney, of course, but anyway, yeah, MAGAnomics, that's the word. Lots in here to unpack, of course, an audio annotation, if you will. First of all, got to talk about the key to the whole thing in this op-ed, that 3% economic growth number. As it happens, Fed Chair Janet Yellen was on Capitol Hill today, the second part of her testimony we told you about yesterday. She was asked at one point during the session by Tennessee Republican Bob Corker about getting the economy to grow at 3%.
I think it's something that would be wonderful if you can accomplish it. I'd love to see it. I think it's challenging.
You think that would be very difficult?
I think it would be quite challenging.
Most recent growth rate, by the by, 1.2% annualized in the first quarter. Undeterred, though, Mr. Mulvaney said this morning he's got a whole plan for how the Trump administration is going to get from there to 3%. Tax reform is item A.
When businesses invest in new plants and equipment, they tend to hire more people who produce more. Lower tax rates and faster cost recovery are two levers that will reduce the cost of capital and thereby help ignite economic growth.
Again, not actually Mr. Mulvaney. That all works fine, except for this. Lynn Stout is a professor of law at Cornell Law School.
Unfortunately, raising corporate profits by cutting corporate taxes is unlikely to result in a lot of corporate reinvestment in the current environment. Perhaps the biggest obstacle to significant corporate reinvestment is not the absence of money, but the pressures that are driving companies to return that money to shareholders in the form of dividends and share repurchases in order to keep the stock price high instead of reinvesting it.
The Trump administration, Mulvaney writes, is also counting on solving one of the great, truly great economic conundrums of our time.
We need to boost productivity. Fundamental to that is encouraging capital investment. We've seen for decades that growth in private sector jobs correlates to growth in private business investment.
Abigail Wozniak is an associate professor of economics at Notre Dame, also, by the way, a former staffer on the Obama White House Council of Economic Advisors.
The administration is completely right to point out that productivity growth has been slowing, but it's a really big puzzle right now why even the productivity growth that we do have is not translating into equivalent wage growth for workers. What's been happening for the last 30 years would suggest that even if we meet those productivity growth targets, we are not going to see equivalent wage growth for workers.
We could go on. Mulvaney wrote about infrastructure, cutting government waste, welfare reform, and unnecessary regulation as a way to get the economy to grow. Also, energy policy.
The president's all-of-the-above energy strategy expands the economy's growth potential. Yes, it puts coal miners back to work, but cheaper, cleaner, more abundant energy will also increase investment and employment across dozens of industries, from chemicals to automobiles.
Which sounds great, except for this. Jesse Jenkins is a researcher at MIT.
The budget that the Trump administration has proposed for this fiscal year would involve pretty substantial cuts to energy investment programs at the U.S. Department of Energy, which invests in the next generation of cheaper, cleaner, more abundant energy technologies and resources.
Two more things about the Trump economic plan and Mr. Mulvaney's op-ed this morning, and then we will move on to the rest of the news of the day. First of all, the Congressional Budget Office came out with its analysis of the administration's budget today. The CBO says it would boost economic growth 1/10 of 1 percentage point more than the CBO's current baseline estimate, which is a growth rate of 1.8%. Also, has to be said, we are working with the White House to get Mr. Mulvaney on this broadcast. All right. Elsewhere in this economy, the biannual meeting of the National Governors Association kicked off today, attended by such prominent American governors as Elon Musk and Justin Trudeau. No, neither one of them is a governor, which is kind of the point. There is global turnout at this year's meeting, underscoring the increasing importance that state houses have in shaping what is normally federal economic policy. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff has that one.
Life as a governor can be tough. Essentially, you're the state CEO. But life as a former governor...
You know, we live in Lexington, Kentucky, and I'm out at the country club getting paid to tee off.
Before he was golfing on Thursdays, Steve Beshear was the Democratic governor of Kentucky. He says turnout like this at a governor's meeting would have been very unusual before now.
As long as the Trump administration is in power, you'll probably see this because of the national administration's attitude toward trade and toward multilateralism. This tends to push these other countries to look elsewhere for cooperation.
And it's not just trade. Governor Jerry Brown of California recently invited foreign leaders to a climate summit in San Francisco.
Yes, I know President Trump is trying to get out of the Paris Agreement, but he doesn't speak for the rest of America.
Governors are also stepping up on domestic issues that the federal government once owned. Take immigration policy. Here's former Republican Governor Jim Douglas of Vermont.
On our dairy farms, we need foreign workers in order to get the cows milked, get the crops planted and harvested, and to make sure that our dairy industry remains vibrant.
Steve Beshear of Kentucky says this is why governors are so involved in the health care debate, especially in states like his, which expanded Medicaid.
You know, governors are down where the rubber meets the road. We see the effect of these actions on our people.
Which makes him all the more grateful to be playing golf. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more record highs despite, you know, Washington. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Senate Republican leaders dropped the latest version of the Better Care Reconciliation Act today, as you've heard. While its political fate is unclear, its potential economic realities are very much on people's minds. Back when the Affordable Care Act was still being argued over in court, we talked to a guy named Bradley Gothrop. Back then, he was a self-employed pipe organ builder in Johnson City, Tennessee. Now he is a temporarily unemployed pipe organ builder in Connecticut.
It's a rather small trade, but we are out there. You know, benefits are all over the place. This is essentially an arts job, which means lots of uncertainty and all of the things that go along with that.
Yeah, we had you on back in, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, talking about health care. And you said at one point, premiums are going to be more than your rent. And so you had to figure out a place to live and do without health insurance. What's your situation been since then?
Well, back then I was an independent, and so the usual amount of uncertainty was even further compounded. But that uncertainty finally culminated in the business imploding, and so I went back into working for someone else. And since that time, it got a little more reliable. I've had health insurance, let's see, twice since I went back into full-time employment, and the first time it was more than we could carry financially, and I ended up dropping it. And then we picked it up again in July of last year.
And now, again, you being unemployed, you're going to have to find either a way to do it on the exchanges for as long as they exist or pay some kind of fine again.
Yeah, I mean, I got spanked by the IRS the last time this went around, and with the farcically named shared responsibility payment, I think is what they called it. I'll be facing that situation again unless I can carry it. It's pretty heavy. I mean, it's certainly without an employer paying part, it would be my second largest bill. It's no longer quite as much as my rent, but that has a lot to do with having moved someplace where housing is more expensive.
How much was the fine? How big was the spanking, as it were?
The last time, let's see, I actually have that right here. $1,106 for last year, and that's for a partial year of not being covered.
Right. What are you going to do now, though, with health care changes clearly on the way, if the Senate can figure out what it wants to do? What's your plan?
Well, obviously, some of it will depend on their plan, and some of it will depend on whatever comes next for me for employment. So I'm in a position where the uncertainties outweigh the certainties. If the price stayed the same and I went back into some reasonably gainful full-time employment, I would probably be able to keep it. But if either of those moves very much, that's probably not going to be realistic. I'm the kind of guy they want on the exchanges, right? I don't smoke. I don't drink. I'm young. I'm active. We pay, you know, if this premium was continued for a whole year, we'd pay about $6,000 in insurance and we'd probably get out $1,000 in care.
As you look now for employment, whether it's going to be pipe organs or some other craft that you have, how important is it to you to find someplace that has healthcare benefits?
I'd like to see it. I mean, until recently, I worked in a shop where there's always the possibility that one of the tools will decide to separate you from a finger. I suspect any sort of regular full-time employment is going to be able to do something for me in terms of helping out with the insurance, and that's probably the biggest factor that would discourage me from going it alone again.
Well, Bradley, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
China is rolling out an ambitious new infrastructure project that, if it actually does come to pass, will affect more than 60 countries and cost China nearly $1 trillion. It's called the New Silk Road, and the BBC's China editor Carrie Gracie is traveling the length of China's new train route that'll stretch as far as Britain. She filed this report from Western China.
China's biggest theater stage is not in Beijing or Shanghai, but in the far west. The Xinjiang Grand Theatre needs to be big to hold 200 performers plus their camels and horses for a musical spectacular about the ancient Silk Road. In her dressing room, Buhalima Abdurup is talking me through her costumes. She's a 21-year-old Muslim from an ethnic minority called the Uyghurs. They used to be famous for song and dance, and it makes her sad that they now make the headlines for other reasons.
Some people did some bad things, and it's affected all of us.
Buhalima complains that a series of knife and bomb attacks by people she describes as separatists and fundamentalists have made others afraid of Uyghurs like her.
We're misunderstood. There might be bad guys, but they can't represent us. We would never act like the terrorists, those rats who destroyed the greater good.
The onstage story is ethnic harmony, with the ancient Silk Road driving prosperity. The theatre's giving jobs to more than 100 Uyghurs. An investment in the new Silk Road is intended to give many more a stake in the system. I'm on a high-speed train shooting west. In less than a decade, China's built a high-speed rail network that is twice as big as the rest of the world's combined. And it's pushed that network far out west to try to bind the troubled, poor, arid regions of China's interior into the national economy and kickstart growth. Framing the perfect selfie on top of a camel and against the backdrop of Dunhuang's magnificent dunes, these tourists look completely relaxed. But as they head west to troubled Xinjiang, do they fear becoming targets for terror?
I'm not afraid. There are people looking after our safety everywhere we go.
A small group of people are causing trouble, but 99% are good.
A dizzying dance of maidens, merchants and monks, with the audience craning their heads to see the acrobats and eagles above them. No expense spared on this theatre or this show. But the more China invests in its new Silk Road story, the more it has to protect.
The BBC's Carrie Gracie in Western China for us. Coming up,
shakes, terrors. It was a lot of anxiety.
The boss will see you now. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 20 points today, about a 10%, 21,553. NASDAQ up 13 points, 0.2%, 62.74. The S&P 500 climbed 4 points, about a 10%, 24.47. So, healthcare, Hospital Corporation of America, HCA Healthcare, delivered a 0.1% today. The insurance company Cigna gained about 0.5%. Kentucky-based insurer Humana cut 0.4% today. Some of the big banks are about to report earnings following Fed Chair Janet Yellen's two-day appearance before Congress. Citigroup, earnings expected tomorrow, secured 0.1% today. J.P. Morgan Chase, also reporting tomorrow, deposited about 0.6%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.34%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Silicon Valley has some explaining to do, as we all know, when it comes to how tech treats women. Uber and its recent turn in the sexism headlines is just the most recent example. But there is a systemic part of this, too. A survey by a Silicon Valley venture capital group last month showed that, no surprise at all, tech startups with at least one female founder wind up hiring more women overall, twice as many women, in fact, than companies with no female founders. So with that in mind, from Youth Radio, Grace Vaughn Brecky talked to some younger women considering careers in tech.
I'm at Hackbright Academy, an all-women's coding boot camp in San Francisco, where 22 women are learning the computer language Python. The walls are covered in cheerful post-its with handwritten notes that say things like, "You're amazing." Some women are even high-fiving each other as they solve problems. 26-year-old Camilla Miner is learning to code for the first time.
Where do the angle brackets go? Just here?
Yeah. Women make up only about a quarter of the tech workforce. But Miner thinks Silicon Valley's gender problem might also be an opportunity.
There is a big need for women.
She thought about going to college after emigrating from Brazil. But instead, Miner opted for the boot camp at Hackbright. It costs $16,500 for the 12-week course, an investment Miner hopes will pay off with an entry-level tech job.
We focus mostly on, like, being good enough. So there's going to be, like, no reason for anybody to bring up that, like, you're not a man and you're not good enough.
But Allison Scott, a researcher at the Kapor Center for Social Impact, says a recent study suggests that in tech, being good at what you do isn't enough.
We found that women experience significantly more unfairness than men.
Scott and fellow researchers surveyed more than 2,000 people who left tech jobs. Women reported the highest instances of being stereotyped, sexually harassed, and being passed over for promotions. Women of color had it the worst. All that unfairness leads to high turnover.
Unfairness alone costs companies a staggering $16 billion per year.
But the study found companies can save on turnover costs when they invest a little moolah in things like hiring an inclusion director and setting diversity goals. 25-year-old Danielle Olson got her bachelor's in computer science and engineering at MIT. Now she's getting her PhD there. She's basically a coding superstar, but she didn't always feel like one.
I really believed that I had to be Bill Nye the Science Guy to be successful in engineering or science, you know, have his personality type, you know, his interests, even the way he dressed and looked and talked.
Olson, an African-American woman, says when she got into MIT, some of her high school classmates told her she only got accepted because she was Black. She says it took years to feel like she belonged. Now, though, she plans to become a college professor and mentor others in computer science.
Kind of the more I learn about engineering and science, the more I realize how important it is that I'm here.
If you like it, then you should do it, regardless of gender.
That's Christy Dong, one of my colleagues at Youth Radio. In August, she's heading to UC Merced to study computer science and engineering. I ask if she has a plan to address potential sexism.
I'll tell them to stop because it's not comfortable and it's not appropriate.
Do you think that you'll be able to just say stop and people will stop? And if they don't, what do you think you'll do?
Then I'm just going to suck it up and deal with it because I would like a job.
Christy, who's 17, told me that by pushing the status quo, hopefully the next generation of women engineers won't have to deal with the same struggles. In San Francisco, I'm Grace Vaughn Brecky for Marketplace.
Grace's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. Okay, true story. Yesterday afternoon, as I was looking to see what was on the show rundown for today, I got an all-staff email from HR here at Marketplace reminding us that performance review time is upon us. First of all, ugh, because, I mean, who really enjoys performance reviews, right? But also, karma, because on that rundown I was looking at was a story about performance reviews, which you're about to hear. Workplaces, as we all know, have changed, even in just the past couple of years. Office walls have come down. It's all about teams and collaboration and innovation and disrupting the old order, or at least being ready when things disrupt you. And that eye on the future thing is changing the nature of annual performance reviews as well. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, at some companies, judgment day comes a lot more often and is a lot less judgy.
Chris Arnold is a lawyer, and for years he spent the night before his annual performance review.
Oh, brother. Night sweats, shakes, terrors. It was a lot of anxiety.
That's because Arnold didn't know what to expect. Would he get a raise, make partner, or be greeted with a nasty surprise? That once-a-year look-back approach didn't really work so well for companies either. Beth Jones is an expert in work management. She says neuroscience has shown us that motivating people and driving change requires a steady stream of feedback.
It is what our brain is looking for all the time. Five times a second, it is scanning the environment.
Scanning it for validation and clues to how we're doing. Jones says that's one reason 75% of big companies, including Deloitte, Cigna, and Cargill, have changed the way they evaluate performance. Some companies have gone to more frequent performance reviews. Others have dumped them all together. Nobody's talking about this anymore.
The term was called, rank and yank.
That charming expression comes from the Army and refers to listing best to worst and sidelining the worst. GE pioneered its corporate use decades ago. Lots of companies adopted it, and lots of them have let it go. These days at GE, the feedback never stops. Standing on the shop floor of an advanced manufacturing facility outside Pittsburgh, operations and facilities leader David Pinson says,
"Now it can happen at any time, during any day, where you're doing something and someone will come up and basically say, 'Attaboy,' or, 'Have you ever considered this?"
In fact, GE doesn't use the term performance review anymore. It's all about performance development. Janice Semper, GE's culture transformation leader, helped establish the new system. She says it was part of moving into the digital era and leaving behind
a command and control type of leadership style, which was very synonymous with the industrial era.
Semper says changing GE's culture to put more focus on coaching and collaboration has taken years. But the shift was critical if the company wanted to hold on to its workers and stay competitive in a fast-moving market.
The more volatile and uncertain and dynamic the environment is, the more important it is that people get a sense for how they're doing.
Remember Chris Arnold, the guy with the sweats and the shakes? He now works at Shell Games, a game design company. They do ongoing reviews. And on days when he has one, he says,
I'm very relaxed.
Part of this newfound relaxation, reviews and salary talks no longer take place at the same time.
That dollar sign sucks up all the oxygen in the room.
And unlike at his old jobs, Arnold may be the one making other people nervous. At Shell, workers review their bosses and their peers.
There are no sacred cows in our studio, and we're just looking for a system that is sustainable over time.
That's the case at many companies. They're tweaking and trying to figure it out. The one thing they have in common, they're willing to change. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which banking is revealed to be a dangerous business. An ATM repairman in Corpus Christi, Texas, had a rough day yesterday. He locked himself inside the room that leads to the back of the ATM. He left his key card to unlock the door and his cell phone outside the room, hence no way out. He finally tried slipping a note through the ATM receipt slot when customers came to get money. Apparently, some of them thought it was a gag, yeah, until somebody heard a voice coming from inside the ATM and called police. Well, Oh, my goodness. Look at the time we got to go. The Dow up 20 points today, a 10th percent. NASDAQ up 13 points, 2/10 percent. S&P 500 up 4. That is about a 10th percent. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor and the voice of Mick Mulvaney today is John Gordon. Maybe he's got a career in voiceovers after this managing editor thing. I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.